I'll stand up here. Before I forget, after Adam's lecture, there's a reception on the fifth floor in the senior dining room, and we have wine for about 100 people, and I think we have somewhat less than 100 people, possibly about 60 people, so you should go and drink one point something something person's worth of wine. Anyway, I hope you can all join us for that upstairs on the fifth floor in this building. As you'll know, tonight's lecture is given in honor of Isaac Shapira, professor of anthropology at the LSE for almost two decades, who died last year at the age of 98. It's appropriate that our speaker on this rather more formal part of today's event should be Adam Cooper, who was a close colleague and friend of Shapira's over a period of many years. As almost everyone in the room will know, Adam is professor of anthropology at Brunel, where he's based in the Faculty of Human Sciences and Law, and where he's built up a hugely impressive research and teaching program in anthropology. Long before that achievement, Professor Cooper conducted field research for his doctorate in the Kalahari Desert, in what is now Botswana, followed by further research in other parts of southern Africa and in Jamaica. But over time, of course, Adam's come to be best known for his research on the intellectual history of anthropology. His books have been widely read and cited, and have played a significant role in shaping our discipline's sense of its past and its future. All of these books are highly readable, intelligent, and perhaps most importantly, provocative in the good sense, asking readers to engage seriously with questions about the point of social science in general and of anthropology in particular. As you'll know, Adam has often framed these questions in terms of life stories, more specifically, in terms of the intellectual trajectories of individual scholars. And I'm delighted that he's agreed to be here tonight to share his thoughts on Isaac Shapira's very remarkable life and career. Adam.
Thank you very much. Now, the first thing is to see if the... I'm not very good at this sort of stuff. Let's see if it works.
At least some anthropologists believed that you study the traditional culture, and they wanted me to go to this tribe because of this. But in fact, what they did not know was that the group of Bakata I went to were a junior branch of the Transvaal section. So, in fact, if I'd gone to the Transvaal, my famous introductory card would have been a washout. But I liked what I saw in Machudi. And I went, have you got that? One of my books.
Married Life?
Western Civilization, perhaps. Or, can you get this picture in? That was Isang Pilani at the day of the installation of the young chief. So I went up to him afterwards on the same day and said, look, I'd like to study your tribe. Is it possible? By all means, he said. And 2-3 days later, I was sitting in his house. He was giving me... He was acting as an interpreter. There were two old women he'd called to give me information on garden magic. I was full of magic then. Malinowski having just written a book on that. And a message comes through to the chief, the missionary wants to see him. He says, tell the missionary to go away. I'm busy writing a book with Dr. Shapira.
Well, my first problem is, what am I going to call him? Raymond Firth always called him Isaac. I think that most of his friends in England used to call him Shap. But for his family and his South African friends, he was always Saki, which is, of course, the Afrikaans diminutive of Isaac. His parents, Herman and Rosie Shapiro, immigrated to South Africa at the turn of the century from what is now Belarus. And they settled, now I've got a couple of Namaqualanders here, I just want to check on the pronunciation, in Garies. It's not Garies, isn't it? Well, yes, Garies, which is a small town in the semi-desert district of Little Namaqualand in the Northern Cape. They came with their first two children, Max, who became a country storekeeper, and Annie. And another three children, all sons, were born in South Africa. Isaac, or Shap, or Saki, was born in Garies in 1905, and he was the youngest. Now, poor Jewish immigrants to South Africa from Eastern Europe at the turn of the century often made a start as peddlers in rural Afrikaans-speaking districts. And Herman worked as an itinerant peddler, and for a while he kept a drapery store in Garies. Now, the Shapiras would have had very little to do with the disenfranchised non-whites who in Namaqualand were so-called colored people, some still identified as Hottentots. But even a modest family, white family, had servants, and Shap had a Hottentot nanny, about whom he often used to speak. In 1911, Herman moved his family to Cape Town, but they would always go back to the dorp for their holidays, lodging with Annie, whose husband, Nathan Abrahamson, had a hotel in the town. And during these holidays, Shap was befriended by a district surgeon called Laidler, who had an interest in local history and traditions, and who let him loose in his library. In Cape Town, Herman tried various ways of making his living, but not very successfully. In 1918, Rosie died shortly after Shap celebrated his bar mitzvah. He observed 9 months of mourning and then told his father that the rituals were doing him no good and that he would not attend the synagogue any longer. His father said, well, he wasn't a believer either, but he had felt that his children should be given something of a religious background, including instruction in Hebrew. A year after Rosie's death, Herman remarried to a widow with 7 children of her own. And Shap's relationship with his stepmother was absolutely disastrous. And at the age of 15, in his last year at high school, he left home and went to live alone in a boarding house. And he stayed on there when he went to the University of Cape Town in 1921 at the age of 16. And for the rest of his life, he lived in furnished rooms in boarding houses and hotels. Now, despite this dreadful unhappiness at home, Isaac and his brother Louis were doing very well at school. They went to the South African College School, which was a grammar school in Cape Town, to which poor children could go as on scholarships. And in fact, Shap was a year ahead at that school of Meyer Fortas, who, of course, famous anthropologist. He once told me that Meyer always came first in his class at Sachs. And I said, well, you know, what about you? He said, no, I came second. I said, who came first? He said, a boy called Solly Zuckerman. When Shap arrived in London as a postgraduate student, he and Louis were estranged from each other. Louis had come as a physician. Shap was inclined to blame the break on Louis's new wife, but he always felt very close to his sister Annie, and in time to her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, in particular his great-niece Carol, who is here today, who came to live in London and provided him with a home from home. At the University of Cape Town, Shap began as a law student. He said, well, this was a Jewish family tradition. Elder brother studies medicine. Younger brother goes into law. But in the second year of the degree, you had to take one course in another subject. And he says because of the influence of the books he had read in Laidler's library in Garies, he decided to try the new subject of anthropology that was being taught at the University of Cape Town by a new professor, Ratcliffe Brown. Now, in fact, Cape Town had not only acquired a new professor, it was pioneering a completely new discipline. This was the first established chair in social anthropology anywhere in the British Empire. Moreover, the science, as he called it, that Ratcliffe Brown was teaching at the University of Cape Town was very different from the orthodox anthropology of the time in England, even though he was appointed to the chair in Cape Town by an advisory committee in London, which included the whole anthropological establishment, Haddon, Marrott, Fraser, and Rivers. In his inaugural lecture at the University of Cape Town, Ratcliffe Brown announced that social anthropology was the study, comparatively, of social structures. And social structures were integrated systems. Any change in any part had repercussions to the rest of the system. And he then drew a moral for South Africa. He said the traditional social systems of the African peoples of South Africa had been completely transformed by European interventions. We inaugurated something that must change the whole of their social life. And in consequence, he said, and I quote, segregation is impossible. Now, this did not imply that South Africa could be governed as a moral unity, he said. The different communities based their laws on different principles. For example, the Europeans relied on contract, while African people preferred to rely on ideas of debt. But although he favored gradual change, in fact, Ratcliffe Brown said it was a law of sociology that so slow change was best, he prophesied that in South Africa what he called a new product of civilization would emerge, which would combine black and white elements. And in his farewell lecture in 1926, which was fully reported in the Cape Times, which gave it a great deal of prominence, he said, South African nationalism must be a nationalism composed of both black and white. Now, Ratcliffe Brown's political ideas made the establishment at the University of Cape Town rather nervous. And, for example, he gave evidence to the Economic and Wage Commission of the Union Government in 1925, and he testified, I quote, "This process of assimilation of the natives, that is, their absorption into the European system, not only economically, but also politically, in religion, by education, has now been proceeding for some time and has gathered considerable momentum. And this process is only to a comparatively slight extent capable of control by legislation." He also insisted in this testimony that Africans had the same educational potential as whites. And a member of the commission asked him point blank, "Does an urban black man have the same, should an urban black man have the equal rights with an urban white man?" And Ratcliffe Brown replied, "I cannot see any possible argument to prevent it once he has been brought into our economic system." Now, Chapoys conceded that, he said that Ratcliffe Brown was an extremely good lecturer. He never lectured from notes, but was so lucid that you just copied everything down. With graduates, though, he didn't know what to talk about. He had said it all already. So he made me do archaeology and courses in the psychology of language and physical anthropology. Also, he was thoroughly detached. The only time he became human was when my father committed suicide. It was in the newspaper. Ratcliffe Brown had just been lecturing to me on Durkheim's theory of suicide. He apologized the very next day. It was the only spark of humanity I ever found in him. In fact, Herman committed suicide, went bankrupt and committed suicide while Shapira was at university at the age of 18. Now, Ratcliffe Brown's main course of lectures were on legal anthropology, which as a law student, of course, would have appealed to Shapira. But he also gave a long course of lectures which provided a routine ethnological survey of South Africa, which he interspersed with brief favorable references to Durkheim and unfavorable references to the evolutionists. Schapp would later pass these lecture notes on to his Ratcliffe Brown successor, T.T. Barnard, who came to Cape Town without any knowledge of Africa. And Barnard gratefully used them as a basis for his own teaching, and in due course they constituted the model for Shapiro's own lectures, both at the University of Cape Town and subsequently at the LSE. I have them here.
And they were sent to me by Peter Carston. God knows how he got them. And Chuck, when I told him I had them, was quite interested, moderately interested in looking through them, and said that after I finished them, I should give them to the LSE collection.
Now, Sharp was in the running for a Rhodes Scholarship. But according to his sister Annie, he was passed over because candidates had to have an outside interest, and he didn't have an outside interest. And in the event, Radcliffe Brown suggested the next step in his career. I was completing my MA in Cape Town, and Radcliffe Brown, it was his last year there, said to me, Shapira, if you get a distinction, you get a scholarship. And then you go either to Malinowski in London or to Lowy in California. He opted for London and the LSE in 1925, just a month after his father's suicide. But Malinowski, when he met him, claimed that he didn't have any room for any new students. And he said to Shapira, Seligman is Africa. You come from Africa. Would you be a student of Seligman? Slig Seligman, whose portrait was to hang in Shapira's office in Cape Town, was, of course, a veteran of the Torres Straits expedition, who had later carried out field research in the Sudan on the behalf of the Sudan government. And he purveyed a rather old-fashioned form of ethnology, rather short in ideas but long in detail, mixing cultural, linguistic, and biological observations. It suited Shap, and in fact wasn't very far removed from the spirit of Radcliffe Brown's lecture course on South African ethnology. Seligman, of course, became increasingly isolated at the LSE as Malinowski's influence grew, but his students shared an affectionate regard for him, and he took care of them as best he could. When Sharp's scholarship ran out after 2 years, Seligman arranged for him to be appointed to an assistantship in the department for a further year so that he could finish his thesis. Now, this thesis was based on library sources rather than on fieldwork. He worked up his material in the British Library, sitting next to Raymond Firth, who was writing a dissertation on the economics of the New Zealand Maori, also based largely on secondary sources. Firth remembered that they were seats L5 and L6. And it wasn't long afterwards, of course, that Audrey Richards began her dissertation, which was a reanalysis of South African literature on nutrition. Now, Audrey Richards and Firth were working under the direction of Malinowski, and they organized their studies with reference to functionalist ideas. But Shapira avoided any sociological or historical arguments. His thesis was very much in the Seligman mold, and it provided a synthesis of what was known about the Bushmen and Hottentot peoples of South Africa. The thesis was published in 1930, when Shapira was 25 years old, with a dedication to Radcliffe Brown, and it remained the standard reference work for a generation. Seligman had a small group of students specializing in Africa, and they became great friends, particularly Shap, Evans Pritchard, and Jack Dryberg, and they were very loyal to their supervisor. But of course, Malinowski was transforming anthropology at the LSE at the time, and they all attended Malinowski's seminars, although they tended to react against his personality and his dogmas. And what Shapira said was, Malinowski asked you questions, and you had to think. Now, Radcliffe Brown, he said, never made you think. He just dictated. Beautifully clear, but you never thought. Malinowski made you think. And he kept thinking, it's quite clear, for many years afterwards, about Malinowski's ideas. But he was decidedly ambivalent about the man himself. He recalled traveling with Firth to join Malinowski in Oberbozen in the Tyrol during the university vacation of 1927, where one of his duties was to scrub Malinowski down with medicines while he lay naked. except for a modest piece of cloth covering his genitals, and discoursed on the psychology of kinship. He also said Malinowski once advised him to change his name, and that he replied he would do it if Malinowski first changed his. Malinowski took him on twice as a research student, research assistant, but he sacked him both times. According to Schapp, the first sacking was because he refused to take Malinowski's shoes to be mended. The second time, Malinowski sent Schapp to the British Museum to find a quote which would prove that Freud had suggested responses to his patients. "I spent a fortnight reading Freud, came back and said, I can't find anything." He said, "You, get out." Now, Schapp would often talk, this haunted him, he'd often talk about these tensions with Malinowski. And he'd refer one to the American edition of Married Life in an African Tribe, to which Malinowski had contributed a preface, which Shapiro only discovered after he received a copy of the book. And in this preface, Malinowski said in black and white, Shapiro was a student of Seligman. You see, not a student of Malinowski at all, student of Seligman. But in fact, Malinowski had done Schapp a favor. He had written to the American publisher. He had got the American edition out. And the quarrel might have been quite a bit more complicated than Schapp ever admitted. Certainly, he later felt some remorse, perhaps some apprehension. In June 1931, he wrote from Matsudi in the Bechuanaland Protectorate to congratulate Malinowski on the Ward of the Rivers Medal and to apologize. "I'm afraid that I left London feeling rather bitter against you. But subsequent reflection has convinced me that I was to blame throughout for the strained nature of our relationship. I feel ashamed to admit that I allowed my youthful conceit to run away with me then, and I can only hope that you'll be able to forgive me for the intolerable rudeness I displayed towards you. I have regretted it bitterly ever since I came out here, especially as I've begun to realize how very much I owe to your kindness and to the stimulus of your teaching." And then he went on to describe his research. "The Bakhatla whom I'm working among have been affected to a very considerable degree by European influences. And I have a good deal of interesting data on the nature of the changes brought about by this type of culture contact. What has impressed me most is the fact that although the old tribal ancestor worship has been almost completely displaced by Christianity, magic still flourishes very strongly, and even church members of high standing resort to the magician at the beginning of the agricultural season." Malinowski replied with very unusual promptness, and he wrote, "I'm extremely glad that you're tackling the changing African." And he went on to accept Shapiro's apology and said, "I shall not attach any undue importance to past events, which I associate with the state of your health. In this connection, may I tell you that you ought to have at least 1 or 2 hours exercise every day. Graduated Swedish gymnastics are far the best." So Shapiro then goes back to South Africa in 1929 and begins the fieldwork among the Bakhatla. He tells that little story with which we started. The following year, in 1930, Mrs. Hernley, who was teaching anthropology at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, took a year's leave, and Schapp came to teach her class. It was a small class, but among his students were Max Gluckman, Ellen Hellman, Eileen Kricher, and Hilda Cooper, all of whom became anthropologists. Now, they'd been attracted to anthropology by Mrs. Hernley, and part of her appeal was her engagement with political issues. She was active in a liberal think tank, the South African Institute of Race Relations, and her students were typically politically involved, Max Gluckman and Hilda Cooper, close to the Communist Party, Ellen Hellman, a liberal. And this was a very fraught political moment. In 1929, after an election that was dominated by the race question, an Afrikaner nationalist government had come to power with a program of Afrikaner cultural revival, ethnic mobilization in politics, job reservation for whites, and racial segregation. It was also to prove sympathetic to the Nazi movement in Germany. Now, I'm not sure to what extent Shapiro's lectures touched on current affairs, but he did claim once that Eileen Kricher walked out of his class complaining he was teaching sociology and not anthropology. But Hilda Cooper recalled, and I quote, "He was not an inspiring lecturer. but he had wonderful material. You had to tell yourself, don't go to sleep, what he's saying is good. During the vacation, Shapira took these students to the field with him, to Machudi, which Hilda Cooper says they found a strange experience because they'd just been reading Malinowski's Argonauts with its very romantic account of fieldwork. This was not Shapira's style. Yeah. This is her description. Staying usually in a trader's home, Shapira would sit in a chair in the sunshine, working at a table with his main informant, whom he would get to collect others, and they would discuss and debate. He was very good at asking demanding questions, and he also went to the courts to listen to cases, but it was an approach very different from Malinowski's. Shapira told us to write down what we saw and heard, but he asked us to stay away from his best informant. In fact, Shap worked almost entirely with informants, either specialists, rain doctors, chiefs, elders, and so on, or through the agency of literate assistants who interviewed their neighbors, friends, and relatives on his behalf. These assistants were typically school teachers who had temporarily suspended, generally, or so you like to say, for getting a schoolgirl pregnant. And he paid them and some of his informants a daily rate equivalent to their usual salaries. These assistants collected census and genealogical material, carried out interviews, and wrote essays on topics that interested him. As time went on and his command of Setswana improved, he collected more texts in the language. He also copied all the documents that came his way, including court records, which he was to mine for many years. The mind boggles at what he would have done if he had had a photocopying machine. So he wasn't doing participant observation. Also, his field expeditions were much less extensive than those of the Malinowskians. Between 1929 and 1934, he made annual visits to Machudi, the Katla capital, usually in university vacations, spending just over 14 months in the field over this period of 15 years. One advantage was that he gradually achieved a sophisticated command of Setswana. Another, of course, was that he could work up historical materials while in the intervals of doing ethnographic research. Initially, he collected oral histories, village censuses, genealogies, and focused particularly on marriage, magic, and Christianity. In 1934, he began to do applied studies for the Bechuan Land Administration on law, migrant labor, and land tenure. He spent a further 4 months in 1934 among the Ngwato, and between 1938 and 1943, he made intensive research visits to other of the Bechuan Land tribes. In the meantime, of course, he was teaching. He was teaching at the University of Cape Town, where he had joined Barnard in 1930, settling once again in a boarding house, which is now the Mount Nelson Hotel. Now, the new discipline that Radcliffe Brown had established in Cape Town had survived the rumpus provoked by his political opinions, but it was not in very good shape. Barnard, the new professor, was a dilettante, more interested in horticulture than in anthropology, and he did no research in South Africa. Students could opt for elective courses in social anthropology over 2 years of the BA degree, but classes were small. At the undergraduate level, teaching was exclusively in the form of lectures. Shapira succeeded to the chair of anthropology at the age of 30, but he didn't introduce any radical changes to the syllabus, and he seems to have been a dutiful rather than a dedicated university teacher. His lectures were almost entirely on South African ethnography. David Hammond Took, who came to the department as a master's student in 1947, said Shapira seldom raised theoretical issues, although in broad terms endorsing the ideas of Radcliffe Brown. We did not hear an awful lot about Malinowski. The textbooks he prescribed for undergraduates were Golden Weiss's Anthropology, Linton's Study of Man, and Seligman's Races of Africa. During the war, he seems to have made a point of addressing racist theories. He came up with what became a very famous definition of an Aryan, which most of you have heard, of course. The Aryan is a man with a white skin, a thick skin, and a foreskin. But on the whole, he left government policy to be discussed by a lecturer in African law in the department, Jack Simons, who was a member of the South African Communist Party. But Chap was active in broader national networks of what came to be called African studies. And he served a term as chairman of the sort of national network of African studies. And it was a very delicate situation because strains were already becoming apparent between a liberal faction from the English language universities and the leaders of the Afrikaner team, Iselin and Lestrade, who were radical conservatives. These strains became more urgent as the new government, the Herzog government, developed plans for thoroughgoing racial segregation. G.P. Lestrade, who had established the ethnological section of the Department of Native Affairs in 1925, advocated separate development for the black population. Then Iselin, who had been professor of ethnology at the University of Stellenbosch, became an advocate of separate Bantu education. These were very bitter debates, and the great South African historian Macmillan issued a blanket denunciation of the anthropologists as, in his words, paralyzed conservatives. But in fact, Hernley and Shapira did articulate an alternative perspective, which recalled Radcliffe Brown's ideas about the emerging South African society. It was during this fraught period that Schaap edited two volumes, Western Civilization and the Natives of South Africa, which appeared in 1934, and The Bantu-Speaking Peoples of South Africa, published in 1937. And these were mostly written by members of the Inter-University Committee on African Affairs. And the volume on Western Civilization opens with a preface by Radcliffe Brown, in which he restates the Radcliffe Brown line. Europeans and natives, he said, have exercised a steadily growing influence upon each other's lives. It is no longer possible for the two races to develop apart from each other. He pointed out that Lestrade and the Native Economic Commission had advocated a policy of strict segregation, premised on the revival of traditional culture. But he said this was completely impractical in South Africa. Inexorable change has been entrained for a century. There was no way in which this process could be stopped or even controlled, short of what he said, complete authoritarian control of all possible influences by the administration. A thoroughgoing policy of adaptation, that was the word that was being used at the time, thus calls for complete segregation of the native under complete absolute administrative control extending to every aspect of their life. As things are now in South Africa, this condition is not likely to be realized. Moreover, even if the policy were feasible, what is to be its final outcome? What place is to be given ultimately to the native in the social and political system of this country? This question, the Native Economic Commission shirks completely. And in the essay that he wrote on cultural change and tribal life in the second collected volume, he summed up his views on this matter. Of the Bantu as a whole, it can be said that they've now been drawn permanently into the orbit of Western civilization. They do not and probably will not carry on that civilization in its purely European manifestations. It is more likely that in certain directions, at least, they will develop their own local variations. But these variations will be within the framework of a common South African civilization, shared in by both black and white, and presenting certain peculiarities based directly upon the fact of this juxtaposition. Already such a civilization is developing, a civilization in which the Europeans at present occupy the position of a race-proud and privileged aristocracy, while the natives, although economically indispensable, are confined to a menial status from which few of them are able to emerge with any success. There has grown up among the Europeans an idea of race purity and race dominance, according to which the integrity of white blood and white civilization must be maintained at all costs. And so we find special legislation and usages of social intercourse directed on the one hand against miscegenation, and on the other erecting artificial barriers against the cultural advancement of the blacks. But despite all this, the Bantu are being drawn more and more into the common cultural life of South Africa. But in fact, the battle lines were not drawn so simply between the segregationists and the assimilationists. And Schaap's position was not without its ambiguities. Malinowski visited South Africa in 1934 as a guest speaker at a conference on African education, and he seemed to discern a process of cultural syncretism at work. I think he was probably influenced by some of the early studies of urban Africans in Johannesburg, which had been carried out under Mrs. Herney's direction. And Malinowski argued that there was a dynamic mixed culture emerging in the city slum yards, and that this would spread. This view, it was interesting, was endorsed by a black South African who came to study with Malinowski and became a professor at Fort Hare University, Z.K. Matthews, who later became a leading figure in the ANC, but it was completely rejected by Radcliffe Brown. Radcliffe Brown insisted the crucial developments were in the field of social organization. Tribal societies were being drawn into national, political, and economic relationships. And this is the perspective that Chap himself developed in a symposium that Malinowski put together, in fact, on social change in Africa. Now, Malinowski also endorsed what he called a sophisticated nationalism or tribalism, which can still draw full strength from the enormous residues of old tradition. Malinowski formed an alliance with the Swazi king Sobhuza, who'd been influenced by the Zulu cultural movement in Kata, which was established in 1922. And Sobhuza was promoting a neo-traditionalist policy in Swaziland. He came to the education conference in Johannesburg precisely in order to press for the revival of Swazi initiation ceremonies. He argued that they would provide young Swazi with a sense of identity and discipline. This initiative was opposed by missionaries and also by some educated Christian Swazi, but Mrs. Herney and Schapp actually had visited Swaziland earlier that year at the invitation of members of the administration and had written an official report which recommended the revival of the regimental system. I think Malinowski was probably influenced, as others have argued, by sympathy with nationalist movements in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But in Africa, the endorsement of particularist ethnic movements generally implied support for authoritarian chiefs and might even be taken as lending support to policies of segregation. I think that these choices were less stark in the context of the British protectorates, Swaziland and Bechuanaland, than in the Union itself. And in any case, the implications were different in Swaziland, where Sobhuza was pushing for a full-blown traditionalist regime, and in Bechuanaland, where the chiefs were, on the whole, modernizers. But whatever their views on Christianity or economic development, one thing that all the chiefs were united on was their prerogatives. And Schapp, in fact, particularly in his more general essays, usually represents the Tswana chiefs as agents of progressive change, although he does criticize some of their excesses. But his descriptions of the chiefs are very free of the sort of celebration of traditional leaders that characterize some contemporary South African studies, notably the Krige's Realm of the Rain Queen and Hilda Cooper's African Aristocracy. Nor did Schapp defend British policy in the Protectorate. His first serious paper on the Cutler dealt with the complex but largely detrimental effects of labor migration and with the sometimes perverse effects of mission policies, which undermined family values and eroded traditional safeguards on sexual morality. But I think what really distinguished his research from a very early stage was the focus on what came to be called cultural change or social change. Now, it's important to realize that this was part of a very general movement in British anthropology at the time, under the inspiration of Malinowski. Argonauts of the Western Pacific had opened with a lament for the cruel irony that just as the importance of the facts and conclusions of ethnological research is becoming recognized, the material of our science is vanishing. But in a paper published in 1929 in Africa entitled Practical Anthropology, Malinowski abandoned this elegiac tone and demanded what he called an anthropology of the changing native. And this shift in Malinowski's line was influenced by the fact that the Colonial Office was at last showing an interest in social and legal research in Africa. This was because the Colonial Office was beginning to reform the system of indirect rule. And in 1934, in fact, the Bechuanaland Protectorate did duly issue two reform bills which began to cut down, or at least constrain, the powers of the chiefs. This was the background of Shap's first commission from the Bechuanaland Protectorate Administration. But there was a more specific impetus. A group of new young chiefs were coming along who would have to take control of tribal courts, but who were ignorant of tribal law and, in fact, had often been educated abroad in boarding schools in South Africa. So the older chiefs, the older generation, said they would need a handbook, a book of laws which they could use. And this is what Shapira aimed to produce in his handbook of Tswana Law and Custom. In the introduction to the handbook, he says, look, this isn't a book on law, it is a book of laws. And so he's not going to deal with theoretical questions. He's also not going to deal with the way in which the law may or may not be enforced, he says, or obeyed in practice, the many subterfuges employed to circumvent the law, the occasional violation of recognized court procedure and principles of justice by autocratic, biased, or venal chiefs or headmen, and the surreptitious exercise of power and rights now declared illegal by the administration. He said if he treated that sort of stuff, it would just cause resentment. And in any case, he said these matters are abuses of the law, not parts of the law itself. But he did promise a further study, which he never wrote, which would deal, quote, with Tswana government and law as actually seen in practice and not merely as represented in the statement of formal principles. He also emphasized that this book of Tswana laws was not a book about the ancient law, the traditional law. His aim was to give a statement of the laws that were enforced at the time. And this was surely the most original feature of Shapira's codification, the insistence on the emergence of a modern Tswana system of law, fed by traditional principles, but also by tribal and government legislation, and responsive to social changes in the society. But while he did his best to avoid theoretical debates about law, he couldn't avoid some fundamental problems. He didn't cite any authorities, but his view of law was based on the familiar positivist dictum of Oliver Wendell Holmes and Roscoe Pound, that law is what the courts enforce. And the Tswana had two relevant terms here, mokgwa and molao. He translated the first as custom and the second as law, and he said the Tswana distinction reflected the fact that the courts punished breaches of the law but didn't punish breaches of custom. But he had to admit that this distinction was very difficult to maintain. In the absence of a published code of law, the courts, he said, have to deal with customary rules of behavior, with traditional usages habitually followed by the people and regarded as more or less binding and obligatory. And he suggested that the criterion for identifying a law should be the probability that the court would enforce a particular rule. But he had to concede that this was a very difficult calculation. And in practice, I think, one has to admit that it was Shapira himself who decided which Tswana rules should be codified as laws. Now, the success of this handbook of law and custom was sufficient that Shapira was commissioned to do later studies on migrant labor and on land tenure, which were discussed in the previous session. But I want to just talk briefly about another and very different essay that he wrote on social change. His one attempt to reach a broader audience, Married Life in an African Tribe. Now, this book was surely inspired by the success of Malinowski's Sexual Life of Savages, which had been published in 1929, just as Shapira made his first visit to Machudi. Although Malinowski's book had been a huge success, although it didn't match the success of a book published a year before by Margaret Mead, entitled Coming of Age in Samoa. I think these were the models for married life in an African tribe. Shap presented his study as a social history, and in the way with which his readers were familiar, he said he wasn't going to talk about the theories of the family, the theories of kinship. My object has been rather to describe in a straightforward manner how the Khatla family has changed and what sort of life it leads today. He drew on letters and often very startlingly frank personal statements, usually, I think always, collected by his assistants, which described in unprecedented detail courtship, love affairs, and sexual practices, including masturbation and homosexuality. And above all, he documented the day-to-day life of a married couple. But while Margaret Mead and Malinowski had celebrated the sexual freedom of Trobrianders and Samoans, Shapira painted a very bleak picture of the love life of Botswana. If I appear to have stressed the unhappy marriages too much and to have paid too little attention to the happy ones that do also exist, it is because the latter, so far as I could judge, are comparatively rare. Few of the women I got to know well enough to talk to on this topic pretended to be living harmoniously with their husband. Almost always there were complaints of sexual ill-treatment or of infidelity, and the characteristic female attitude was one of resignation rather than of happiness. The polygamous ideal still prevails, and the virtually enforced monogamy of today has not been accompanied by the true companionship upon which a successful union should rest. He said, Western civilization, through the changes it has produced, must be held mainly responsible for the lack of happiness and contentment now so frequently observed in married life, although there is little to suggest that even in the old days these emotional satisfactions were a common feature of the Cutler family system. Well, the book caused a certain amount of local controversy. Chikidi Khama was very shocked by its sexual frankness, and so was the Archbishop of Cape Town. And Shapira, in fact, got a radio call, public radio call in the field, from the principal of the University of Cape Town, enough to make any academic shiver in his boots. Serious complaints have been made on account of your book. Will you please come back to answer them? In retrospect, Shap said, the problem was, quote, according to my description of sexual intercourse among the Cutler, it was very much like the way the civilized Europeans committed sex. There was nothing exotic about it, and that's what annoyed the serious crowd in Cape Town. But in any case, the fuss blew over, and despite the best efforts of the Archbishop of Cape Town, the book never became a bestseller. I think precisely because of the lack of exoticism, but also because the Tswana didn't seem to be having more fun than anybody else. Now, I don't want to go on, there's no time, but in any case, I would strain your patience, discussing in great detail Shapira's later work. I just want to conclude by making a few comments about his departure from South Africa and his subsequent career in London. By the late 1940s, he had stopped doing fieldwork. By the end of the year, he was no longer visiting Bechuanaland. In 1948, the nationalist government came to power in South Africa, and in 1950, Shap came to London. And I often used to ask him whether he had come to London as a result of the nationalist government coming to power in South Africa, and he always said not. But this was very much in retrospect. I began asking him this question 20 years afterwards. Now, the nationalist government which came to power had a new policy which came to be called apartheid, which was actually designed by the ethnologist Werner Eiselin, who was, of course, a contemporary and a close colleague of Shap's. I don't know the answer to this question. Shap always said he came to England because Evans, Pritchard, and Firth were trying to arrange jobs for him, and one came up. In any case, he found a serviced room in the White House Hotel off the Euston Road and was to remain there for half a century. New routine was established. Mornings would be spent at the LSE, where he would lunch. He'd then walk home and spend the afternoons at his desk. In the evenings, he would drink whiskey and read. Where possible, weekends were spent with friends or relatives. But while, as many of you have said in the previous session, he could be warm and hospitable and entertaining, he had the set habits of a confirmed bachelor. He had once been engaged to be married to Hilda Cooper, but he had no enduring love affairs. There was a time when his drinking would cause trouble, particularly with the wives of his friends, and he became lonelier than ever as his friends died off. I think that the operation he had on which damaged his vocal cords just the time of his retirement certainly made him much more unwilling to go out into society than he'd been before. At the LSE, he was a very loyal lieutenant of Firth, and Firth wrote him a letter. Shap wrote to Firth a letter to congratulate him on his 101st birthday, and Firth wrote back to thank him and to say that in their friendship, which had begun in 1924 at the British Museum, continued unbroken for nearly 80 years, they had never had a serious quarrel. I think that was right. But he had a certain resentment and a certain rivalrous feeling about Firth, and he was delighted that he beat him in at least one thing, which was by living longer than he did. He retired from the LSE in 1969, took early retirement, bored with teaching, which he never much enjoyed, but also very unsympathetic to the student insurgency of the time. So I'm not going to let the students tell me what to teach. He was orderly and ascetic, lonely, liable to depression, and he had a way of erasing the past. He never kept letters, and the only review of any of his books that Simon Roberts found among his papers was a rare, unfavorable review by Eileen Kricher. He seldom returned to the places in which he had spent the important years of his life. After completing his research in Machudi in 1934, he returned to the town only once for a week. After leaving South Africa in 1950, he went back on visits only three times to Cape Town, once to receive an honorary doctorate from the university. He returned only twice to Botswana, both brief visits. After his retirement, he very rarely visited the LSE. His work had been the I should also say that he destroyed all his papers. His work had been the center of his life, and he felt his work was the center of his life, and he felt diminished when, well into his 70s, he found he had stopped writing. But he never stopped reading. He was eclectic in his tastes, but he favored 19th-century English novels, Pepys's diaries, and the Bible, all of which he liked to read as ethnographic documents. He regretted that he had forgotten his Hebrew, but I think he hardly forgot anything else. To the very end, he would effortlessly quote poetry, the Victorians again, reel off scholarly references when asked for help, copy edited one essays with intimidating precision, and tell pointed stories about his teachers and contemporaries, stories that tended to improve with each retelling. Thank you.
Remains for me to thank Adam for a really wonderful, fascinating lecture. And as I said before the lecture, we're now going to go to the fifth floor of this building for a reception. Could I ask those of you who don't mind walking up to please walk up to the fifth floor, because there are just two lifts up front. Thanks.